So, if you were listening to the first hour, or if you weren't listening for that matter, we were speaking to three affected homeowners who effectively were recommended by engineers for full demolition as part of the defective block scheme. That was by engineers who visited the site. That was off the back of core testing that was taken as well. Then they were told, a desktop review effectively it seems, that they were being downgraded and various other options, i.e. in one instance, leaving the rising walls, leaving the roof, leaving the internal walls, but replacing the outer and inner leaf walls. That was the option. And they're going like, well, what's going on here? We've already been recommended for demolition. It throws up so much uncertainty and questions being asked. And it kind of makes you look at the Attorney General's advice back a couple of years ago a little bit differently. The 100% Redress Party councillor, Joy Beard, joins me on the programme now. Joy, thanks for taking the time to chat to us.
Yeah, thanks for having me on, Greg.
Right, what's your party's reaction to, I suppose, these people coming out and outlining their lived reality?
Yeah, well, it is a lived reality, and we have to remember that. This is people's lives that are being affected by these decisions that are being made. It's becoming more and more aware that more people are becoming downgraded by housing agency engineers. Now, these are independent engineers, I've been told, but they are employed by the housing agency. I think there's 76 currently have been downgraded, and it's just not acceptable, to be honest.
I didn't realise the scale of it. That's an interesting figure to have, 76. Yeah. What I thought was interesting is, and I can't find the information here, but I think it was from Katrina, who did a Freedom of Information request, right? Sorry about this, I'm just finding it here. Right, she did she was on the scheme from 2020. She was downgraded on the 20th of May. So she had a verbal approval for a demolition in August 2021. So she says, well, what's going on here? Applied for Freedom of Information to see why she was downgraded. The council said, we don't have paper files, everything's on the portal. But what she did discover is that it was written, she had a subsequent test then that was submitted to the portal, presumably, last year. And it was written in block capitals, do not use this in under the enhanced scheme. So new, an updated test of materials of the house and what have you, and it was actually precluded from being even considered under the enhanced scheme. That again, too, all feeds into this problem. Very worrying and hard to make sense of.
Yeah, it is extremely worrying. Exactly. As I say, we're very concerned that these homes, some of these applications have been submitted over 3 years ago. Now, we know these houses are deteriorating quite rapidly now. Many of these homes are unsafe, and as Katrina mentioned earlier in her interview with you, they're unhealthy as well. These latest developments in the property need to be forthcoming and need to be considered when they are doing the appeals process. For this not to be considered doesn't make any sense at all. Fresh information needs to be submitted to strengthen the case for demolish. We have to remember that these remediation options, this causes further problems down the line. We know Engineers Ireland have said that IS 465 is not fit for purpose, and this is the standard being used. So therefore, engineers, will they sign off on these properties with still remaining with deleterious materials? You know, I don't think that's going
to happen. Attorney General's concern is that they might. His actual concern is, and sorry, you're talking about signing off once they've been remediated. His concern is that they might recommend demolition. That's under IS 465. Sorry, we'll come back to the mortgageability and saleability of the properties afterwards, because I know that's what you're referencing, Joy. But yes. I just want to, because exactly. We hear IS 465 all the time, right? And maybe there's a presumption that everyone understands the significance of that. Yeah. So why does IS 465 feel outdated? Why does it need to be reviewed?
Well, we know initially when we realised there was a problem with the homes, the standard IS 465 was the standard being used to test for mica. Now, that was a desktop study, Greg. There was no scientific evidence to prove that it actually was mica in our homes. And don't get me wrong, there are properties, obviously, majority of properties have excess mica. but it now is an internal sulfide attack, has been proven by world-renowned scientists that this is the issue with our homes, that there's pyrite and pyrotite causing a reaction within our blocks, which is causing the deterioration, as well as the mica. That has to be considered as well. But the main cause of the deterioration is the internal sulfide attack.
So does IS-465 focus primarily then on mica still, and, you know, the level of mica in the block? Is that still really the primary focus when we are testing blocks? Because you do then hear people say, you know, pyrite and pyrotite was also picked up in these tests as well. So I do get confused at that point. If IS-465 is picking up these other deleterious materials, can you explain a little bit why then it's important that it's still revised?
Yeah, it does need to be reviewed. The IS-465 allows for mica only. So it does need to have these deleterious materials included.
Understood.
This is the heart of this scheme, and this is why properties are getting the remediation options that they are. With this internal sulfide attack, the only solution for these homes is to demolish the homes in full and replace the foundation. That is the only way these families are going to get away from this nightmare that they're living on a daily basis.
Right, so let's get back to what happens with option 2 to 5. So say, for instance, someone goes through that process. Who might the engineer be? Is it a new engineer? It's an engineer that did original testing? Is it the Department of Housing engineer? Who signs off at this point on remediated homes?
Well, as it stands, it is an engineer, you know, a homeowner engineer. You know, you'll engage with your architect. We'll organise that when your remediation has been done, and they should sign off on it. But Greg, the problem is we've heard it in the Oireachtas Committee on Housing and Local Government and Heritage. I think it was the 14th of May, you know, and they sort of indicated that this IS-465 is not fit for purpose. They actually said that. So if the Engineers Ireland are saying it's not fit for purpose, how can the government not take in these other considerations? And to be honest, that standard needs to be taken away and a new standard for these homes formed. You know, it's just not acceptable that these families, this is hard enough for these families, and to be downgraded based on, and a lot, we have to remember, a lot of these homeowners don't even have a housing agency engineer come out and inspect the properties. You know, it's all done visually, done on a desk, where a lot of them haven't even visited the property. You know, but the scientific evidence is there. You know, these reports cost €6,000. And for them not to be, you know, they have to consider them, obviously. But when a professional engineer who is registered with Engineers Ireland said your home needs to be demolished, and then now the housing agency have taken over, they're saying, no, we're downgraded that to an option 2 to 5. That's hard to take for a homeowner
but
who's already
this,
been living.
What about this, and I think Charlie McConlogue referenced this in his statement last week, what about this commitment from government that if you go for anything other than a full demolition and rebuild, you maintain eligibility for a second grant if required for a period of 40 years? So that seems to be almost like a 40-year guarantee of the works. That's not tested yet, is it, in terms of the sale of the property? Maybe if interest rates change, if you want to switch lenders. We don't really know how that might be viewed yet.
Exactly.
That's completely uncertain. We can't compel lenders. They might find another reason not to take it on.
Exactly. Well, that's the thing. I do feel that homeowners are going to be trapped in these properties, and that's a big fear of mine, that they're not going to be able to live their lives the way they want to. They're not going to be able to move homes. They're not going to be able to remortgage. You know, that they're basically, unless they have a cash buyer for these houses, that they're never going to be able to leave these homes. And that's a massive concern for families, you know, that their futures have been decided for them, basically, because of the remediation option that they've been given, which is totally unjust and totally unfair, you know.
Just about signing off on remediated works, and I'd love to speak to engineers in relation to this. If it seems to be generally accepted that if you only did outer leaf, that the inner leaf is going to go. It's the same blocks, effectively, or the rising wall, or some people call it different things, or even the foundations. I find it hard to see how an engineer with that knowledge could actually sign off on something. Why would you stake your reputation by signing off on a project if you had any concern whatsoever? just seems like an obvious question to me.
Exactly. You know, obviously these are professional people. They know what's happening within these blocks. The blocks are the same, inner and outer. You know, there's no, you don't get a block, a load of blocks delivered and told, right, do that block on the outer leaf and do that block on the inner. That makes no sense. So engineers, obviously signing off on these would have to be 100% sure that these homes will not deteriorate in the future. And I don't know of an engineer now that I've been speaking to that would give that, you know, sign it off on that basis. Again, you have to think about their indemnity insurance and what have you. You know, down the line, if the home fails again, you know, they're going to be liable, you know. So it is a massive, massive worry for engineers as well. You know, so until IS 465 is reviewed and hopefully the right conclusion made based on the science, I think that's the only way that engineers would feel comfortable signing off on these homes.
And I mean, I'm just saying, say I got the outer leaf of my house repaired and someone comes up, I want to sell it. And they come up and they go, all right, any mica in the house? And I'm sorry to use the word mica, you know, any defective concrete in the house. And I go, oh, well, yeah, well, we went through the scheme and we've got the house fixed. And then they say to me, oh, is it a brand new build? I said, well, no, the outer leaf. We just got the outer leaf done. That was fine. And they say, well, what about the inner leaf? Is there a defective concrete in that? Well, it was the same blocks as the outer leaf, but we've been told that they're okay. What about the rising walls? I've heard that and I've seen them deteriorate. Well, we were told that it's fine. Anyway, I'm looking for €320,000, please. Can you imagine? Like,
no, that's what I mean.
Even a cash buyer, Joy, who would make the biggest purchase of their life under those circumstances? Maybe they would, I don't know. And it's an open platform. Anyone can text in if they'd be happy to do that. But you might say, well, look, I'll give you 180 for it and take the risk. You know, what does it do to house prices and the value of these properties?
Well, this is it. You know, we have to always remember that these are lives and people are living this daily. You know, people have planned their futures, Greg, based on their homes as well. It's an asset. You know, I've spoken to people who want to downsize, but with the remediation option they're being given, they're thinking they're never going to be able to sell their home, you know, and take any equity out of their home, you know, which is, you know, leaving people, you know, with their futures uncertain, you know. But I think the big thing at the moment is these families, since, you know, some of these downgrading and the appeals have been ongoing since January, you know, with nothing coming forward. You know, I don't think any appeals have actually taken place yet, even though the appeals panel has been set up.
Who is on the appeals panel? Do we know, Joy? Who's on the appeals panel?
So there is a list of engineers, independent engineers, and other engineers.
Are they? Is that a separate list to the?
It's independent. Yeah, it is totally independent from the housing agency.
My point is, we've got a group. They're all trained the same, really, effectively. So we've got a group of engineers that make an initial recommendation. I don't know how many engineers we have in this country. We've got a separate group of engineers that make an initial recommendation. Then we've got another group of engineers that make a determination on behalf of the Department of Housing. And then, lo and behold, we found another group of independent engineers then that review appeals.
Yes, exactly.
Wow, we have a lot of engineers in this country.
Well, some of them will be one and the same, possibly, Greg. I haven't a list of the housing agency independent engineers who they've employed, but a lot of the engineers, some of the engineers could be on that list as well, which to me, it's not the right way to go about it. They should be totally independent.
Right,
and I think for the appeals process, even the two engineers, the homeowner engineer and the housing agency engineer initially, would need to air their concerns and get together and look through the report and explain why the options are being given to these homeowners and why they're being downgraded.
And I think I'm only asking really simple questions. I'm not trying to be clever or anything. Yeah. Joy, thank you very much. Councillor Joy Beard there of the 100% Redress Party. Art O'Leary is Chief Executive of the Electoral Commission. He's with us now. Good morning, Art. Thank you very much for your time.
Oh, good morning, Greg. Great pleasure to be with you again.
Right. So talk to me about the establishment of the Electoral Commission on Commission Tiahan. Why was it established and what's its work?
Well, an Electoral Commission is something that exists in most democracies around the world. Irish people, for the first 100 years of our existence, trusted the government to run elections in this country, but it is international best practice that there would be independent oversight of the electoral process, which will just ensure that our democracy is protected and enhanced, and that we can have an independent look at all of these things outside of government, just to make sure it works okay.
And I mean, there's obvious things that perhaps need to be looked at. One is the broadcast moratorium. I can see the benefit of it. I was never comfortable with it, and I'll tell you the reason why, is because up until relatively recently, people on the islands versus people on the mainland, they were treated differently. And we've got populated islands around Donegal, and I thought that was unfair. That seems to have been aligned now. But the broadcast moratorium means radio and television broadcasters can't report on elections or referendums from 2 p.m. the day before polls. But in this day and age, where so much is consumed online, it seems out of date, Art.
I couldn't agree with you more, Greg, because, and that's why we made a very strong recommendation that we should remove the broadcast moratorium, because it is, I mean, if I can be crude about this, a relic of a bygone era where most people got their information from radio and television. But now it seems completely unfair that after 2 p.m, as you said, radio and television can't cover election issues in the important day before polling day. But there's a really energetic and often wild conversation going on online and on social media. And our recommendation is basically just to level the playing pitch, because we did some research in the recent referendums around when people made up their mind what way to vote. And we discovered to our surprise that 20% of the Irish population made up their mind which way to vote in the 24 hours before voting. Mm-hmm. You know, and this is extraordinary. So in that 24 hours, most of that time, radio and broadcast media wasn't available
as a
source of information for
people. Also, clever people are exploiting it now, because if you are an online-only publication, right, you can drop a bomb just as the moratorium kicks in. And it actually makes the radio and the broadcast media effectively look stupid, because everyone's discussing this bombshell that's been released by an online publication after the moratorium. And we have to sit there like idiots on our hands, and people go, oh, you're covering that up, oh, you're not talking about that. That would be one of my main concerns about this moratorium as well. I think it's a disadvantage to broadcasters.
Oh, I think you're right. You know, the danger there are the potential for mis and disinformation or any stories that might be out there.
Even competition.
I can understand that as well, but I mean, there is a large coterie of people in this country who get their information from radio and television, and it's all about, to my mind, the quality of access, and again, the ability of some of the mainstream media to comment on issues right up to and throughout polling day, to my mind, is very important.
Another issue I think that's in your target lines as well is the ballot paper. I'll be interested to see what part of it you think needs to be cleared up. I mean, we, of course, had the famous 2-foot-long European election ballot paper, where you literally had to travel 2 feet. Very disadvantageous for people with vision issues as well. I spoke to a couple of people that struggled greatly with that in a confined space. But what are the concerns the Commission has in relation to ballot papers?
Well, the first issue, I suppose, just we're talking about the referendum here, is that people, because we had 2 referendums, one on family and one on care, people weren't easily able to distinguish which was which. The word family and the word care was presented in the title of the bill rather than as a heading on top of the ballot paper. So, I mean, we had 75,000 hits on our website on polling day. Many of them were people who were trying to work out which paper was which and which colour ballot paper was which. So they need to do a much better job in relation to labelling. But on the wider issue, I mean, we're going to have a look at that as part of our research programme, because There is not much we can do about the size of the ballot paper, because it's not difficult to get on the ballot paper in this country. And as a nation, we seem to like that part of our democracy where you can stand for election. There was, you will recall, Greg, because you've been interested in these things, in 2011, they ran an experiment in Wicklow where there were 23 candidates. So rather than having one single long ballot paper like the toilet roll, it was two columns with 12 on one side and 11 on the other side. And unfortunately, the difficulty about presenting the ballot paper like that is that people voted 1, 2, 3 in the first column and then 1, 2, 3 in the second column as well. Yeah. So rather than 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. So
I know people.
There's an education piece here.
For sure. And I know people, though, and sorry for conflating the awkwardness of the ballot paper itself, and the quite rightly, I struggled, and I'll tell you, even in the debating process, Art, it was difficult to keep contributors on care and on family. They were switching between the two, and I was struggling, actually, to be honest with you, in my own work to try and sort of stay focused on various issues, to not switch between the two myself. But also, like, I know a lot of people sort of with a soft touch interest in politics, but did want to get involved, losing interest quite quickly on the long European ballot. So, of course, obviously you had some spoiled votes in the Wicklow experiment, but then you had people going 1, 2, 3 on the top and not even considering anyone who might have been called Zelda or something right at the very, very bottom. What would be the significance of doubling the period of notice for polling day? Why do you see it needing to go from 30 to 60 days as a recommendation?
It is just to give us time, Greg. I mean, this was our first referendum, and it was a great learning experience for us, because we're a new organisation, just over a year old now. And with the work that is involved in delivering 2.3 million booklets, information booklets, to every household in the country, and trying to reach groups of people who traditionally don't get engaged in the electoral process. I mean, it's a huge job. And we had a little over 13 weeks for this particular referendum. And that included the busy Christmas and New Year periods as well, where it's hard to grab people's attention. But we were restricted a little bit in time. So it meant that many of our information booklets weren't dropping through people's letterboxes until the final week before polling. And that's not enough. If we want to take our constitution seriously, as it should be, those leaflets should and booklets should be in people's houses 2 to 3 weeks in advance of the referendum, so people can properly study these issues.
And does that apply to referendums only, or for general elections as well, I wonder?
Just referendums for us, because we have a specific function in relation to making sure that people have enough information so they can decide which way to vote. The general elections themselves, local and European elections, you will know that many of your listeners will have received the litter umhaukhoin from many of the candidates. And this is run between the candidates and an arrangement with An Post in order to coordinate those. I don't see any particular difficulty having arisen in that regard, but it's just for the referendums where we have a specific function.
Yeah, exactly.
We would like sufficient time.
Yeah, I don't mind the snap element too, that can be there for general elections. All right, Art, thanks so much for your time. I know you're busy this morning. Appreciate it. Take care.
Yeah. Great pleasure.
Bye.
Thanks again, Greg.
That's Art O'Leary. Who is Chief Executive of the Electoral Commission. I'm sure you'd welcome some of those changes. It's common sense stuff, isn't it? Much of it's, excuse me, much of it is common sense. Right, let's take a break. Back shortly. Paul McLaughlin of Balaghdar Garden Centre, Mountaintop Letterkenny's in studio with us. Paul, good morning to you.
Good morning, Greg.
Now, I did forget to mention either yesterday or earlier today that Paul was in with us. So if you have any questions as it relates to your garden, your potting, whatever it might be, get them into us now. And I will get them to Paul. 086 60 25 000 is the WhatsApp and text. If it's easy for you to describe your question, send a voice note to 086 60 25 000 on WhatsApp and I can just play it to Paul. And he will give you an answer, of course. Paul, I was fiddling in front of the car yesterday. And this is not a gardening question as such, but you are out and about in the garden. And I looked at the front of the car and there wasn't a fly, a bug, a gnat, a dragonfly, a daddy longs, whatever you might call them, right?
Yeah.
And then I thought, I don't think I've slapped myself around the face trying to avoid a wasp yet this year. And then I was thinking, actually, how many bumblebees have I seen? There's not been one wasp in the house, one bumblebee. I haven't seen any out. And as I say, I have this, and it could be like that Streisand effect. I have this memory of when I had cars in the past, the front of them just being bugs everywhere and the struggle of getting them off. Is it just me, or are we seeing less?
Definitely this year, as there's less bumblebee activity, there's just less insect activity.
Yeah.
I think it's just the constant damp and sort of the temperature's not there to bring them out in the numbers that they should
so
be.
So it is just really weather-related rather than ecosystem-related.
Yes, I would have thought so. I suppose you would hope so, to be honest, if you know what I mean. But no, definitely this year is noticeably less, even in the house. Far less flies or anything. So
That's it. I mean, the flies are stubborn buggers, but it's just the other stuff. You just don't. And midges. I haven't felt midges this year.
Yeah, funny. Last night actually was the first night I noticed any midges.
No, I don't miss those little buggers.
No, absolutely not.
But yeah, talking about the weather, of course, and we can't avoid it. It's very, very wet.
Yes, absolutely. Last year was the wettest on record, and I think this year certainly looks like it's going to beat it as much as anything else now. But you still have to be hopeful that it's going to come around at some stage. So you would?
Really, mid-July, you want me to try and remain hopeful?
Yes, absolutely.
Okay, I shall. because, of course, any changes in weather, and people can argue amongst themselves about whether they're natural changes or man-made changes, affect different places in different ways. And here, you know, it makes me laugh when people say it's raining, what are you on about, global warming? People that have radio shows and actually are reasonably intelligent comparing weather to climate and thinking that every part of the world is just going to get really, really hot. It's naive.
Yes, know, absolutely naive, not.
So as to say, whether this is a natural trend or man-made, we're going to see wetter summers.
It appears to be, all right.
Modern winters and stuff.
Yeah, then if you look at places like America, Las Vegas there, it's just burning up at the minute.
Unbelievable what's happening. Right, okay. Growing food. We can do that now.
Absolutely, so you can still set stuff now, but hopefully if you had stuff set earlier in the year or you're coming into a time now of sort of abundance, that there's plenty of stuff available now. Your potatoes are sort of generally from mid-July, people's first potatoes are ready.
And traditionally the 12th of July was also a date where your tatties were ready, haven't been planted on St. Patrick's Day, an interesting connection between two dates there.
Yes, absolutely. It used to be all there. The saying was you put them in with paddy and take them out with Billy.
Yeah.
So that's it. So the 12th of July always was a was for certain traditions, was a mark of pride to have your potatoes for the 12th of July.
There are pockets of Donegal under a blight warning from Sunday.
Yes.
Does that mean get them out if you can or what?
No, pretty much it'd be just a matter of keep them sprayed if at all possible. And just obviously the danger is that sort of if you get blight, it makes it more transferable to your neighbours, if you know what I mean. So just keep an eye on it, basically. But spray with whatever you deem appropriate, if you know what I mean.
But you would be expecting that people who planted around about St. Patrick's Day or whenever they did, they could start digging them now?
Yeah, pretty much. But digging the early potatoes is sort of, it's an ongoing process.
Yeah.
It's like you can't do it all once because it won't keep that long, if you know what I mean. So no, generally from now, people should be digging away.
Dig them as they need them.
Pretty much, yes. That's the benefit of having your
own. You can do that. Have here in my possession two. Oh, and it's such a distinctive smell. And I'm going to eat them later. These are for me. You're not taking them away. They are two peaches.
Yes.
Right? This one's still got the... And this, obviously, they smell like peaches. What a stupid thing for me to say, right? But 0 air miles on these little buggers.
Absolutely. They've travelled about 3/4 of a mile there to get here, so they have... So, no, that's just an example of what you can grow around here. That's obviously, they've come out of a polytunnel, if you know what I mean, but down there we have a good, decent crop of peaches at the minute. And a sort of, once again, getting them fresh, you can have them just straight off the tree.
Right, okay. And how big's your harvest off a tree?
Harvest off a tree, I'd say you'd be looking maybe 3-4 pound, if you know what I mean. So it's not huge, if you know what I mean. But obviously, we've quite a mature trees down there, but even I've seen ones down around and get
now,
over there.
I'm not having a go at your peaches, right? Mm-hmm. Okay. But is that really... That's not a shape we're familiar with from a shop. It looks like you sat on the way up.
Pretty much, but that's actually... There's a moral tale with that one as well.
Go on, give us...
The reason I took that this morning is because that branch actually broke.
Aww.
Because what I should have done earlier in the season was remove some of them. There was too many in the branch, and the branch actually broke, so they're probably not fully ripe yet.
You can see why...
Yeah.
Their bums are called peaches, aren't they?
But they're...
Are they ready to eat now?
Yes, absolutely. Okay, so they are. So you can chance it. Well, what do you think?
What a flavour.
Yes, actually, now this, once again, it's the flavour of homegrown. It's always that wee bit better. So it is now.
Wow. Really, really juicy as well.
Yeah, so it's hard to believe you get grow such things in Donegal, like.
Mum, well,
I was going to say, I'll just chat on now. let you have your breakfast.
They're really, really tasty.
Yeah. No, they're lovely. All right, so they're nice. But it's amazing that you can grow such things.
And what do you do with them? They're just peaches. They're just
fruit. Just peaches. No, we just eat them off the trees as they ripen, if you know what I mean. So we do. I'm sure there are probably our recipes you could follow for preserving them.
No, why would you?
Much like jam and that, if you know what I mean. But now, whenever you only have a small crop, you tend to work on like that.
Mm-hmm. Well, you can't drink water.
Yeah.
I made peaches.
Mm-hmm.
What's this?
Yes, that is my. The last time I was on just that evening, I was going actually harvesting my black currants. So that's blackcurrant jam. Right, so very good. But that's blackcurrant jam that me and the kids made. So we have...
Oh, my God.
I would say about a dozen blackcurrant bushes. And we get 6 pounds of fruit off it, which equated to about 12 pots of jam.
And it's perfect, isn't it? It's so smooth.
Yeah, it's funny. That's actually just in the house with democracy. Some people like the seeds net in the blackcurrant and some people don't. So we strained half of it.
Right.
And didn't strain the other half, just to keep everybody happy. So we did.
I'm going to have that on toast. I can't stop eating this peach. So I don't care anymore. I'm just eating this peach and it's lovely. So summer fruits now, they're all over the place.
Summer fruits,
if things went well for you.
Yeah, exactly.
So
yeah.
All the fruits are there?
So your black currants, red currants are probably a wee bit earlier. So they've kind of passed almost, if you know what I mean. But black currants good at the minute, and gooseberries. And then in August you'll be chatting blackberries. And sort of raspberries from now on as well. So you would be. So it's there.
What is it? See that peach?
Mm-hmm.
It's got a toughness to it, right?
Yeah.
But it's not bitter, it's sweet.
Mm-hmm.
Is that something unique about the way? Because normally they're kind of soft and squishy, and I associate tougher fruit with bitterness.
Yes.
But that's beautiful and sweet, but it's got a bit of a more of a bite to it.
I'm not sure what the exact.
I haven't had a peach for a while, if you know what I mean.
I'd say it's probably to the freshness, probably.
Yeah, maybe
like that
just
that
you picked
off
it at
morning,
the perfect
if you know
time.
What I mean.
Absolutely stunning.
So, what I got. But someone like that there, that'd be a variety, sort of be for. Like home use, if you know what I mean. Probably what you get in the shop would be a more commercial variety.
No, well, I'll take that one. I mean, it's quite clearly a peach, but it's absolutely delicious. So hopefully now you've got a good crop of summer fruits. And get your questions in for Paul, by the way, to 086 60 25,000. Your scallions, your onions, your tomatoes, if you're making a salad, they should be well on the way. A wee bit of sun might be nice to finish them off.
Absolutely. Even for like your peaches, even summer fruits, strawberries, that sort of thing, the sun really ripens them that much, if you know what I mean. But I was just checking the onions and the scallions this morning. They're all coming on very well.
Lovely.
So it'll be August by the time that properly store.
Anything we should be worried about with them in terms of enemies or cabbages for that matter?
Cabbages, you have the cabbage white butterfly going about at the minute. He can do a lot of damage very quickly. So we can, as you notice, the wee sort of white butterflies going about. And what they do, they lay eggs in your cabbages. And the caterpillars then come out and they eat everything. So it's just probably the best option for that there is if you actually cover your cabbages, if you have a small amount, you can actually just cover them with fleece or something like that at this time of year.
Of course, as the use of weed killer pesticides is a huge factor in the decrease of the bee population and other insects. I mean, the reality is we do know how important the bee is in terms of pollination and everything else as part of the ecosystem. And we do know that, unfortunately, its biggest threat is probably us.
Yes, absolutely. You know, that's
not a revelation. Like
the decrease of its habitat in terms of taking away the sort of natural hedges that they use for corridors and that, and the use of pesticides in a big way would be problematic for them. All right, definitely.
How do you get rid of mare's tail in the garden? This comes up every time you're in.
Pretty much.
Understand why? Yeah.
Every time. Once again, sort of goes against your thoughts on the bees, particularly in that. But once again, probably your herbicide, that would be the main way of doing it.
Mm.
And because it has a protective coating, you have to sort of break it up.
Smash
first.
It down.
Either be stamping on it or something like that.
Nature has worked very well for it. It's very resilient.
And if it's in tarmac or something like that, you can just use salt, like grit and salt.
Okay.
Would actually just, but obviously you can't use that in soil because. You can't grow anything else thereafter.
Okay,
you know.
good.
But
didn't hear that one before.
Salt does work on gravel areas or on tarmac.
And the big bags you get for ice, that would
perfect.
Do the same job.
Yeah.
Okay, fantastic. Paul, I know it's very late, but would you have any strawberry plugs for planting?
Yes. We do have strawberries down there, all right.
Great stuff. How do you take a slip from an azalea plant, please?
Azaleas are quite hard to grow from slips. So they are now, it's just they're generally a very woody plant. So there would be, now into August, you could try and take a few sort of softwood cuttings of it that might take from it, if you know what I mean. But once again, rhododendrons and azaleas can be, they're almost the rhododendron especially, it's air grafted almost, so it can be quite hard. But the thing about that slips, if you have a parent plant, it's costing you nothing, so just try it a few times. But probably now into August, September, be a good time to try.
We were talking earlier on about stuff we do see and we don't see. Flying ants.
Yes.
I haven't seen any of those, but you're getting quite a few inquiries about them, are you?
Yes, pretty much. Flying ants, at this time of year, it always comes about sort of through July, August, whenever the humidity's right and the temperature's right.
Mm.
The ants tend to swarm a bit. So they do. So they're sort of leaving the queens, leaving the nest that she has, or the excess queen, shall we say, and moving on to find other places where they can set up nests and generate all the male ants follow her for breeding purposes and whatnot. So the fact of the matter is just whenever they do swarm like that, they can be quite terrifying looking because they're a huge swarm of ants. And even though settle in your car, especially if you have a silver car or
yes.
black car, they'll settle on it and just the whole thing can be moving.
Yeah.
But it won't do any harm.
It's giving me the heebie-jeebies.
Yes, so that all they have is romance in their mind. So basically they'll not do any harm. They won't sting you or anything else.
They're harmless and they pass. I mean, they
exactly. Well,
like,
one day, generally, they're gone.
All right, okay. And this is, as you say, this is the time of year where they're reproducing,
yes.
maintaining their survival.
Yeah, pretty much. This month and sort of at the start of August.
And they're important, presumably. They're important too as part of the food chain, of course. You know, birds would.
Yes.
We only see the birds or have the birds because this is one of their food supplies.
Yes, exactly. It'd be a big thing for swallows and that sort of thing. All right, swallows would be one of their sort of main food sources. And even for the ants themselves on the ground, they're always sort of caring about leaves and they're breaking down leaves and that. So they're actually improving soil health all the time.
And there's something here. I wouldn't have thought seagulls go for. Flying ants, but there's a quirk of nature there. What
yes,
happens?
Absolutely. Apparently, the ant, whenever they swarm, the seagulls absolutely gorge on them.
Mm.
And the ants produce an acid inside their body, which is the effect of making the seagulls drunk.
Wow.
So you can see seagulls actually times wandering about, sort of staggering about the place because they've overindulged in their ants.
They've formulated the alcohol themselves or whatever it
yes,
is.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. Apparently elephants can do that too. They would get a store of apples and they'll actually store them.
I've heard that. I haven't heard about drunk seagulls.
Yes.
They're annoying enough as it is without being leery on the booze.
That's it.
Do they start smoking and fighting or anything?
Quite possibly. You never know.
My hydrangeas have lots of growth and big green leaves but no flowers. How can I get them to bloom?
Get them to bloom. A slow release organic feed would be good for them. The problem is for blooming this year, if they're not sort of starting to bloom already, you would worry. You might have still have a few weeks for it to come on. But someone like Miracle Grower's slow release or a quick release fertilizer won't. It'll grow on the plant without actually producing the flower as much. So I would go for someone sort of slow release with a high potash content.
Mm.
Even someone like putting banana skins around it would have a lot of potash in that in it. So would help. But you're probably looking at next year.
All right. I'm trying to grow a hedge. How do I stop wild briars growing without killing the hedge?
Pretty much just to kill anything within a hedge using pesticides or herbicides or anything like that is just generally a bad idea. So only thing to suggest is sort of get out your clippers and clip them out as best you can and put gloves on you obviously for the briars. Yeah. And generally if you sort of keep battling against them, eventually the hedge will get big enough that it'll actually overtake.
Yes, it overpowers.
It'll dominate the space more so than the briars.
It does require
a bit of manual labour.
Yeah, okay.
But if you do sort of little and often, it's not that daunting.
Yeah, this is a question carried over, so I'm not sure if it's still relevant. Any advice on growing tomatoes in a tunnel? Is it too late for that? Or?
It's getting late, all right. Okay. If you still put a few in, you still might have a chance, if you know what I mean. Growing them, just generally keep them fed at this time of year, especially even if you have established plants. Feed them every 2 weeks or 10 days and basically keep them regularly watered. Just make sure that sort of the flowers, sometimes in a polytunnel, there can be trouble that the tomato doesn't actually, especially this year, with lack of flies that and lack of bees, that the flower isn't actually getting pollinated. Mm. So if you think you have lots of flowers and none of them turn to tomatoes, you're actually doing literally just give them a gentle shake.
Yes.
That'll release the pollen and produce more tomatoes.
Any recommendations for a fast-growing evergreen hedging? Cost-effective too, as it's a large boundary.
Yes. Our most popular one by a mile would be Gristlinia, which is a very good, very easily grown evergreen hedge. Grows very well from slips too. So if you had the time, what you could do is sort of buy a few, put it in, get it established, and then start slipping it from that and sort of extend your hedge from that initial bit you
bought. In terms of maintenance, does it have to be topped off much?
Chatting once, maybe twice a year. Around that, so it would be quite easily maintained, if you know what I mean.
And how long, ideally, and if you bought enough plants, how long would it take before you could sort of say, well, there's a hedge?
Yes.
You know what I mean?
Generally, obviously, there are a lot of conditions in terms of the sort of site, in terms of wind and stuff like that, and even the quality of the soil. But generally, within 3 to 5 years, you could suggest you had a hedge.
Right. This is why I'm probably going to do a fence. My marigold flowers, they turned all brown. Can I do anything?
Yes. Generally, I would say they're probably victims of the weather. It's just they haven't had sunshine to bring them on. First thing to do is check for slug damage. Slugs would be quite fond of marigolds, so they would. If there are no signs of slug damage, generally give them a trim back, deadhead them, get rid of the flowers, and hopefully if the weather comes good, they should bounce back.
But if we do see a trend where weather more consistently changes, we are going to have to sort of, you know, change what we grow, what we expect and stuff, don't we? I'm not being doomsday here, don't get me wrong. But
yes, no, absolutely.
You know, last year was the same, this year was the same. Yeah. I mean, people aren't going to go through this every year. They're going to want to sort of look at different things, aren't
they? No, but there are certain things that sort of garden goes with fashion as well. If you know,
yeah, true.
In the last few years, because people are becoming more aware of the biodiversity crisis, and that people are going for plants maybe that do sort of reflect nature better or help nature along. So they're supposed to, gardeners are adaptable too, but hopefully it won't come to the old classics get replaced too, if you know what I mean.
I know what you're saying. Acaulis trees are suffering badly. They're growing healthily on the inside, but they appear to be rotting on the outside. What's happening? What can I do?
I would say if they're growing happily on the inside and rotting on the outside, I would say it's possibly wind damage.
Right.
That the wind's just obviously getting to the outside of the tree and affecting it badly. Just give it a good feed and hopefully it'll snap out of it. Any doubts, sort of, if you think there are any actual any disease under that, take a few photos, bring it to your garden centre. The only thing it could possibly be, without knowing the type of tree, would be the ash dieback disease that's become a huge
problem.
Which
you'd hope it wouldn't be.
Yes, you would hope so, but if it's an ash tree, more likely that's what is going on.
Right, so if it is an ash tree, I'm afraid it could be ash back, ash.
Ash dieback.
Ash dieback. Just time for one more. How can I keep my basil plant alive?
Basil plants are sort of, I've always found them hard enough to grow. So generally I would say with basil plants, a lot of people buy them in supermarkets there. And the ones you buy in supermarkets are sort of for instant use almost.
Ones in wee pots are they?
Aye, yeah, exactly. Yeah. They can be quite forced because the environment they've been grown in, they've been given constant liquid fertilizer every day. So if you want to sort of establish a basil plant for continuous use, I would say start from seed.
That's interesting because it is kind of nice, isn't it? Because what you do is you go and buy them in the little plant and in the little plant pot and the wee bit of soil there, and you put them on your windowsill and you go, right, I'll pick some now. But in day two, they're just yellow and lying over the side.
Yeah.
But is there any way to maintain them and sort of keep a supply?
Generally, the basil plants you buy in the supermarkets, actually, if you look at them from the ground up, they're actually a lot of, there's a huge amount of stocks coming up. It's not one plant you're buying, it's like loads of wee ones.
Okay.
So what you could do actually once you get them home is actually split them up.
Right, so it's really kind of more of a
But like I say, a lot of them are liquid fed, and obviously not everybody's going to keep up the liquid feed, true. So they do suffer from a bit of thing.
All right, Paul, listen, fascinating stuff as always. We'll chat to you really soon. Thanks so much for calling.
Thank you very much.
Great. Thank you so much for I'm actually flabbergasted how nice the... I tell you, I was actually quite nervous about trying the peach because I wouldn't actually pretend because if it was like really bitter or tasted funny I probably would have said but absolutely delicious, and I love the texture but all the sweetness and flavour. Remarkable that you grew that up here, and the jam, well, that's going to get a hammering tomorrow morning. Aaron loves jam, so he's going to absolutely love that, as do I. Alright, thanks so much.
Thank you very much.
Always come bearing gifts, it's fantastic. Yes. Love it. Paul McLaughlin of Ballacdur Garden Centre at the Mountaintop in Letterkenny. Mary is with me. Hi Mary.
Hello, Greg. How are you doing?
I'm doing fantastic, Mary. I mentioned earlier on the Lidl or Aldi, sorry, I always mix them up, everyone does. Aldi released figures showing that 1 million plastic bottles or cans have been returned at one or all of their 6 stores. €173,000 returned through the levy to their customers. So one shop, 6 stores, 1 million plastic bottles and cans. It's pretty impressive.
Oh, very impressive. Brilliant altogether.
But
can I make two points before I get into the story, Greg, quickly? Two points about the outcome is, one, it wasn't the principle of the 150 that I didn't get, because whether it's my 150, but it's the principle of the thing with me. And the second point is, I did have a successful outcome in the end, but not the outcome that I wanted or sought after.
Right,
okay?
So last week, 2 dozen plastic
last
bottles.
Week, yeah. A couple of dozen plastic bottles went down to Aldi and both machines were actually full. Contact the shop. And there was other people there as well as me saying that the two machines were full. I mean, I've been using it since day one, since the start, so I'm well used to using them. But anyhow, I hadn't the time to waste to go in to wait in the queue to tell the staff that the machines wasn't working. So I said, right, I had to go to Tesco's anyway. So I thought I'd go to Tesco's and put them in the machine in there. And of course, there were staff that actually witnessed what happened. And I was putting down the bottles, and I put in six big bottles. They took the bottles from me, but they wouldn't pay me out any money. And I called over the staff. I said, look, what's happening? I said, they took my bottles, but they won't pay out any money. So I proceeded and put in all the rest of the bottles to finish off a couple of dozen that I had, and they paid me for them. But I went over to customer service and I complained to customer service what happened. And they were very kind and gave me full details, phone numbers, email address, everything, actual virtual address of the company that owned the machines, as they thought. So, of course, next day I phoned up the company and got a very lovely lady on the phone and told her the story. And she said, oh, it's got nothing to do with us. But can I backtrack? Tesco said they weren't responsible for the machine to start with, okay? That's why they gave me all the details of the company mm-hmm. that was supposed to own the machines. So when I phoned up the people that were supposed to own the machines, they said, it's got nothing to do with us. We don't deal with the machines. I said, well, who does, like? Wouldn't tell me. Said they didn't know. And they said, we only deal with the barcodes on the bottles.
Oh, God.
So even though I persisted and said, well, sure, if they needed fixing, who comes to fix them? And they didn't know that either. So I was getting nowhere, no success. And it irritated me. As I said, it's not the 150, Greg. It's the principle of the thing.
Principle
of it. My word, I think.
So what are you going to do next?
So I went back to Tesco's the next day and I told them the story of all that I went through and everything. And they stood there looking at me and said, well, we're not responsible for the machines. Well, I said, somebody has to be responsible for taking people's money. I said, I'm sure I'm not the only one this has happened to. I said, somebody has to be responsible for these machines, taking people's money, taking the bottles and not paying out the money. Mm-hmm. I said, I've got to get to the bottom of this. So a few staff talked to each other and decided after a conversation to give me back the 150. And I pushed the money back on the counter. I said, that's not what I want.
Right, Mary.
I don't want the 150.
I have to go, but just in two words, has it been resolved yet or are you still fighting?
I'm still fighting.
Okay,
I'm not
Mary.
Happy because, Greg, I want to get to know who owns the machines and why the machines are faulty.
Keep us updated with an update. Thank you so very much indeed. Right, we'll be back with you tomorrow morning at 9. Thanks, Mary. Thanks to Caroline and Shannon working on the show. Caroline researching and producing, of course. We'll be back, as I say, tomorrow morning at 9.